This is Burn, an energy journal. I'm Alex Chadwick. At the intersection of 10th and Alton in Miami Beach, it's flooded by a very high tide. The energy industry helped make this the richest country the world has known. Maybe no place displays it with the dazzling flair of Miami. Cultures, colors, cool, and now climate. Parts of Florida are going to gradually drown, and sooner than anyone is prepared for. On this Burn special, rising seas, how long does Miami have? Plus, reports from the Louisiana Gulf Coast, New York City, and Greenland. I'm Alex Chadwick. This is Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions and APM, American Public Media. This is Burn, an energy journal. I'm Alex Chadwick. Knee deep in Atlantic Ocean water, flooding an intersection in Miami Beach. The highest tides hit South Florida in October. They're called king tides, a nuisance. Underground pipes meant to drain storm waters to the ocean sometimes channel a rising ocean inland. The floods dredge up raw sewage. It smells awful. It's going to get much worse. Fossil fuels that provide most of our energy also emit gases that trap heat in the atmosphere. We've added a lot of it over the last 200 years. The Earth is warmer. The seas are too. Warmer water expands. The seas are rising. Also, Greenland, the world's largest ice reserve outside Antarctica, is melting in a way no one has ever known, and more later on this. But this is what the tide signals. Parts of Florida are going to gradually drown, and sooner than anyone is prepared for. To better understand all this, I came to see a scientist I met at an energy seminar. Just say who you are and what your role is here and what it has been.
I'm Len Berry.
Dr. Len Berry, a distinguished research professor at Florida Atlantic University, FAU, north of Miami by about 40 miles.
My role has been really to build the Center for Environmental Studies over the last 19 years. And the goal was to take good science and apply it to the problems of Florida.
This interview is in August, though I'd been thinking about it for months.
I heard you lecture at MIT back in December. And what you said was new to me. I guess it shouldn't have been, but it was. I asked you then, is the city of Miami viable?
That's right. I remember that exchange.
The data from decades, centuries, are clear. Seas are rising, and they are going to rise a lot more.
By 2100, Dr. Berry, is Miami going to exist as a city in the way that we think of it today?
The short answer is no.
All year, when people ask me what I'm working on, this is what I say. The ocean is starting to swallow Florida. And the response is always the same. Really? Miami is doomed? Why don't I know that? Good question. Through this last blissful summer, Miami rolled in the heat, played in the ocean, danced to the radio, and watched things get better. The real estate crash of 2008 was painful. It's over now, at least for people with money. My best sources are a pair of scientists who work for Len Berry at FAU. I'm in Florida for a Sea Rise conference in June, and they offer to show me around.
We're driving right into Miami Beach. You can see the welcome sign there.
Nicole Hernandez-Hammer manages a project trying to teach people about sea level rise. She started on science as a girl in Guatemala, her mom guiding her on nature walks. Her dad is Cuban. And the way South Florida blends people and flavors and music and language, to her, it feels like no place else.
It's a different culture than other parts of the country. And I want my son to be a part of that. So I hope that he could grow up here.
You have been someone I've been talking to about the changes that are coming here.
Yeah, I'm concerned, very concerned about what lies ahead for Florida in the next 30 years. It's going to be radically different.
We're on a road called A1A. It's a designated evacuation route. And a year ago, part of it fell into the ocean. Side streets are asphalt stubs that dead end against beach.
Are you on turn right?
The other scientist, Karen Bolter, her doctoral thesis compares the perceived and the actual risk of sea level rise.
Why did I settle on that? I think the main reason is that I see that there's not much being done.
She and her husband just bought a house on the cul-de-sac where she grew up.
Why isn't anything being done? Why aren't people concerned about sea level rise?
The elevation of the new house, 12 feet. But that's high ground around here.
Because here I have the data, and I know that they should be concerned.
The coast here is a long barrier island running from Miami north through Fort Lauderdale and on. In places, it's a half mile narrow. Dramatic condo towers crowd long spans of the dune edge, and the high-rise views must be spectacular. The ocean on one side, the intracoastal waterway on the other. It's a long channel of bays and canals that reach far inland in patterns like watery lace. It means many more South Floridians can get to the sea, and as I now understand, the sea can get to them. We're surrounded by water.
And across the way there, I see what look like extremely expensive private homes.
Right.
Which are very close to water level.
That's right. And we have pictures of mansions, huge mansions that are being built right on the water, and you could see the water rising up on top of their docks as construction was underway. Remember, Karen?
Yeah.
We couldn't believe it.
Both women hold advanced degrees in physical sciences. Both are as concerned these days with political science and this term of art, outreach. You have to tell people again and again what is happening, what's going to happen. Nicole Hernandez-Hammer thinks a lot about outreach.
Some of the buildings, the condo price starts at $6 or $7 million per condo, and it just goes up from there.
As a scientist who is studying both what is going on physically with the rise of the seas, and as someone who is also studying the human interaction of what is going on with the community, what do you think about that?
Well, just kind of a head shaking, as you said, astonishment that sea level rise is not a consideration. And from what we see in our research and the research of others is that this is a huge problem for South Florida. Our sense is that people are not considering it at all. And there are a lot of people that are investing in the area that are going to be losing a lot of money potentially down the line.
A risk assessment company, CoreLogic, publishes an annual study of storm surge danger for South Florida. In Broward County, which includes Fort Lauderdale, it ranks the 10 most vulnerable areas by zip code. I get property sale records for the last year for one of those zip codes. I ask CoreLogic to study several parcels, and I start knocking on doors.
We knew that we were in a tough flood zone, a severe flood zone, but we went ahead anyway.
An accountant, Noah Gianelli, on a pretty neighborhood street about a half mile inland. We talk beside a comfortable-looking one-story white house that backs to a canal. He paid more than $1 million for it in June.
We like real estate, and we're not buying to flipping. We're looking for a long-term investment. So we have a vested interest in the environment as well.
His wife and his daughter fell for the place, Noah says. The daughter, Lauren, is going to live there.
I think for future sales and the property sales going up, I think being at the water is important in Florida. So that's the best reason to live in Florida.
When you were buying the house, did the real estate agent say anything to you about the vulnerability of this place for sea level rise?
No, that was never a fact, and that was never discussed.
Has anyone shown you any charts about the rate of increase in sea level here?
No.
An open house in the next block, hosted by a well-known local real estate agent. Is sea level rise something you mention, I ask? No, she says, and names the prominent national company she's affiliated with. They're good, she says. If it mattered, they'd say so. The next afternoon, I'm in the office of Broward County Mayor Kristen Jacobs, a Democrat.
I've been on the county commission since 1998.
She's term limited off the commission next year.
And I kind of joined the board as the voice of the environment, maybe when I first ran.
She lost a race for the State House last year. She'll likely try again. Her resume and maybe her ambitions bolstered since President Obama named her to the National Oceans Council, and she wound up as chair.
Which is just an absolute thrill.
If one place in South Florida is going to get things right, the scientists tell me, it'll be Broward. So how come people here don't know?
So it's logical that at this point they may not know because we're not sure.
Mayor Jacobs, an avowed outreach advocate, says the property risk data isn't certain enough yet to be sounding any alarms. And I'm telling her about the home buyers I just found and the research from CoreLogic. Back to the interview.
Now, you could say it's the buyer's responsibility to know all this, but wouldn't it also be an opportunity for outreach if there were some kind of regulation that said if you're in a zone of this elevation, in the process of buying a house, you must have a discussion about vulnerability?
That's a good point, and I do believe at some point in the future we'll get there. I think it's premature to encourage people to go leave an area now because it's certainly not underwater. If you're a person who's going to live in that house for 10 years and then move on your way, then it isn't your concern. You're going to have 10 wonderful years in that home.
Okay. But for the properties on that block that we checked, a one-foot sea level rise by the end of a 30-year mortgage is easily possible, putting both parcels in extreme jeopardy for flooding from any hurricane, Category 1 to Category 5. Really, these places will flood without a storm, just from very high tides. An analyst who makes data projections shows me his map of a city elsewhere in Florida with another barrier island, most of it highlighted in yellow. That's the area I show them losing, he says, and that is most of their tax base. Can local officials, he wonders, afford to sound alarms? I do find one group acutely aware of flood danger. They've lived through it before and expect to again.
Could you tell me who you are?
Lisa Johnson.
I met her at a high school GED class at the Broward Housing Authority. Her neighborhood is low, the drainage not good.
Basically, every year when it goes to rain and they're pouring down, the streets stay flooded. It ain't nothing new.
The neighborhood is called Sunland, and her place is between New Hope Baptist Church and the Fire Baptism and Truth 2 congregation.
Sometimes it stays for a couple of days, and sometimes it stays for a week, depending on how bad it rains.
A man told me that last year he pushed his children in a shopping cart through 2 miles of Sunland street flood to get to a store.
Over the years, it get worse, because last year, we had knee-deep waters when it started raining.
Okay, I'm starting to get what the scientists have been trying to explain about limestone. Limestone, it's the ground rock for most of Florida, but it's really flimsy rock with a lot of holes in it. And that's what is under Lisa Johnson's house and a lot of Florida. Nicole and Karen, take me to a nature preserve about an hour north of Boca Raton. There's a high dune, almost forested, with a thicket of sapling-like sea grape, about a dozen feet tall. The beach below is steep and narrow, and where it meets the ocean, there's a long face of low stone running north and south. It's limestone, Karen says.
And it's porous, it's permeable, it's a sponge.
The tide is out. I climb down carefully, the stone sharp and uneven. At waterline, the base of the rock is badly eroded, and the limestone forms a broad overhang about 2 feet thick. The smooth undersurface is slow-dripping seawater from a high tide hours earlier. This rock absorbs water. This is why Florida can't use countermeasures that other places can, a seawall, for instance. The water here is not just coming over the top, it's coming up from underneath. And it complicates things in ways I had not imagined.
So saltwater intrusion is actually lifting the water table because the fresh water table is floating on top of this saltwater toe.
Because saltwater is heavier than freshwater.
Right, right. So saltwater is heavier, it's denser. And as it lifts,
much of the intense seasonal rain once settled through the porous limestone to the water table below. But as Karen explains, there's not so much room for the rain anymore.
So as this saltwater intrusion toe pushes further inland, it's lifting the water table closer and closer to the ground surface.
The water table is gradually rising. So when the woman from Sunland, Lisa Johnson, says it's getting worse...
The last little thunderstorm, the rain was real bad.
It is getting worse. Karen Bolter.
And then all of a sudden you have a storm and you have these heavy rains. And where is that water going to go?
That's what I wonder. I saw an operating nuclear power plant sited on a low-lying key south of Miami. There's a debate about what to do. A senior scientist told me an expert he knew had offered advice and been told to mind his own business. By 2030, 16 years and 2 months away, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says a sea rise of more than 6 inches is possible in South Florida, and that's a tipping point. This saturated land is cut again and again by gravity-sloped canals that drain rainwater from inland areas to the sea. Designed 60 years ago, the canals are engineered so the ocean outlet end is above sea level. This is not 60 years ago. Many of those outlets are now 6 inches above sea level. So a half foot more of ocean, and gravity is going to start flowing the other way. It's not just the coast that's going to be in trouble. Why don't people know? It's not hard to find news accounts, some cautious, others alarming. It's certainly in the Miami Herald. But in her surveys on sea level rise, Karen Bolter says many people are unaware. Maybe it's that in places like Florida, there really are not any good answers.
We are careful, but we are not blind. We're not looking the other way.
The mayor of Broward County again, Kristen Jacobs. I probably owe her another word.
It isn't that elected officials are so much worried about tax base as they are the fact that it's their home. It's where their families are growing up, where their business is thriving, and they don't want to leave it.
Yeah. Like the scientist Nicole Hernandez-Hammer. Maybe, she says, people just don't want to know.
People have to deal with the day-to-day of putting food on the table, of taking care of their kids. And so they imagine sea level rise as an issue that's very far off or an issue that someone else, the engineers, are going to figure out.
Nicole and her fellow climate scientist Karen Bolter, clear on the future, clear on the risk, and clear they're going to be here for it. And I mentioned this to Mayor Jacobs.
So even though these are the best informed people I know on this issue, they're still here.
Because we still can be here. And because we want to be here, and for right now, we need to focus on not panicking. There's nothing really to show us the right path other than continuing to work on it.
Here's one last thing to consider. A Europe-based group, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, ranks the 20 global cities with assets and land most threatened by sea level rise. And number one in the world is Miami. You can calculate how rising sea level will affect your city. Visit us online at burnandenergyjournal.com. And coming up, Byrne's mystery correspondent revealed at last. Okay, that's a joke. But he's on a very serious assignment, and he's got the world's best science writer with him. I'm Alex Chadwick. You're listening to Byrne, an Energy Journal from Sound Vision Productions and American Public Media. Welcome back to Byrne and Energy Journal. I'm Alex Chadwick. Sea levels are rising for two reasons. First, the ocean gets warmer. Warmer water expands to fill more space than cooler water. And second, ice melting from glaciers and ice sheets on land. And nowhere is this a bigger factor right now than Greenland, which is why I thought of the writer Gretel Ehrlich. She's the author of several books on the Arctic Circle and Greenland and ice. Gretel, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alex.
And to get to Greenland, she would need a radio producer, a radio person with her, and I happened to know one with some free time over the summer. Neil Conan, welcome back to Public Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
So, Neil, this was your first trip to Greenland, but Gretel, you've been there many times. What was different this time, Gretel?
Well, this time I got to see the whole anatomy of a glacier. We took a plane all the way to the top. It looked as if a hammer had been smashed down on top of the ice. It was just full of crevasses and all kinds of amazing designs pressed down by the great ice on the top of this island. At the bottom of the glacier were huge icebergs, 300 feet high, moving around. We took a boat among them. It was a gray, pale day, and the light was ghostly. Everything was dripping, just water pouring off the edges of these icebergs, and sometimes whole waterfalls just rushing down into the water of Disko Bay.
Neil, first impressions?
I'd never seen any place that looked like this, flying over the ice cap, this vast area. You thought it'd be white, but it was dusty and it was ashen. And then I had never seen an iceberg before. And every morning, looking out from the hotel room window and seeing these icebergs parading past along Disko Bay.
Okay, well, let's get to this story. Neil, take it away.
Disko Bay lies halfway up the granite coast of West Greenland, well above the Arctic Circle. There are no trees on the rocky shore, no bushes, just lichen and patches of grass. And just 2% of Greenland's vast area is bare land of any sort. The rest is covered in ice, 2 miles thick in some places. Offshore, icebergs parade past, dripping in the August sun. Tiny ones in impossible shapes, huge ones that loom more than 100 feet high. You can see some phenomenal pictures at our website, burnandenergyjournal.com. Large and small, they all squeezed out of the Ilulissat Ice Fjord, just south of here. That's an ice-choked waterway that runs deep inland, back to the face of Greenland's biggest and fastest-moving glacier. It's so breathtaking, it's been designated as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO and may be best appreciated from the air. We take off in a small plane from the airport in Ilulissat, turn inland, quickly rise over the ice sheet, and then over the ribs of the glacier, pushing ahead to the sea. There are pictures from the plane at the website, too, and Gretel's notebook. Here's an excerpt.
From here on, we'll follow the fjord out to the sea, the pilot says. 103 miles of ice rubble, a pushed carcass ribbed with turquoise. Down we go in the river of air, over the river of ice, a river that seems not to move at all, but does. Fingers of granite look liquid compared to the stuck ice, with its shining pools of open water on top. There's an ocean ahead, Davis Strait, where soon the ice will be freed to drift. An iceberg cracks open. Here we are, at the end of time.
After many years and dozens of visits to Greenland, Jason Box has become convinced that the ice sheet is melting a lot faster than most other scientists do. Some call his views alarmist, but he argues that his measurements are already well beyond the predictions of even recent models. Box is an American who lives now in Copenhagen, where he's a professor of glaciology at the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland.
Well, I started coming, and at that point, we weren't aware that abrupt climate change was really underway, and the last 2 decades then proved a very sharp rise in temperature that contrasted a lot with the previous century.
You say there are 66, 68, 69, 70 feet of sea level rise cooked into the system.
Yeah, the question then becomes, well, okay, how fast is sea level rising? You know, to be called alarmist is kind of true. You know, it's like, hey, guys, you know, this is a serious problem. But then we realize that the political system itself, it seems almost incapable of responding at the speed that we seem to need. That keeps me up at night.
We wanted to see and hear the ice as it crashes off a glacier. That process is called calving. It's not safe to go up the Ilulissat Ice Fjord. There's just too much ice there. So we joined 30 tourists on a day trip to a smaller glacier about 35 miles up Disko Bay.
That's ice being brushed aside by the bow of our steel-hulled ship, which has just left Ilulissat Harbor. We're on our way to Eki, which is known as the Calving Glacier, sailing through a sea that is just fantastic. Ice of every size and shape, huge icebergs that our vessel dodges carefully around, and, well, all kinds of little ones that we brush through like a slushy. And by lunch, we've reached the serrated face of the glacier, which stretches, it's got to be half a mile across and hundreds of feet high, right on the water. Whole sections of the glacier face just fell away into the sea. Huge waves now rocking the boat. There's more. Great chunks of ice fell into the water, then raised up again like a broaching submarine to float as small icebergs. With each boom and crack, a bit more of Greenland's ice falls into the sea. And those snaps, and those pops, that's the sound of it melting.
Global warming means boom times here in Ilulissat, Greenland's third largest town with a population of 5,000, perched on cliffs that overlook a small harbor. More open water means more opportunity to fish. This summer, the local fishermen reached their limit on halibut early and looked on suspiciously when a big Russian trawler dropped anchor just outside the harbor. Cruise ships and planes bring in 10,000 tourists per year. The government sold licenses to drill for oil and gas offshore, and iron mines are opening up. But it's not boom times for everyone. Winters seem to be milder and more humid now, and the sea ice that carried the Inuits and their sled dogs for as much as 9 months of the year scarcely forms at all some winters. As Gretel wrote in her notebook, because that ice is gone, the four most northern inhabited villages of the world are all dying.
The children of the great marine mammal hunters there are being sent south to learn other trades. They have no future in the north. In one of those villages, Moriasuk, there were maybe 15 or 20 people when I visited in 2004. Quite lively place. Then, one by one, they left. Finally, there were two hunters left. They went out one morning. Accidentally, a gun went off and killed one of them. In remorse and anguish and pure loneliness, the other one turned the gun on himself. Moriasuk is no more.
Jens-Ole Somaisen grew up in Upanavik, a village a bit further south. He lives in Ilulissat now and makes his living as a boat captain, carting tourists among the icebergs. He takes pride in the way that Greenlanders have adapted to new conditions and new opportunities. He keeps a team of dogs in Ilulissat and hunts when there's ice.
My mother's father, he was my hero because he always told me the dogs maybe will save my life. We was out on the sea ice and he told me now all the dogs spread out on the ice. That means we are on the thin ice because dogs know to spread out and when they are together, then ice will be safe. And I didn't know that.
And some people would say, we're all on thin ice now.
We are really in thin ice now, maybe because of the pollution of the air. Ice melts faster than before.
No one has studied Greenland's ice longer than Conrad Steffen. For many years, a professor at the University of Colorado, now director of the Federal Institute for Forestry, Snow, and Landscape in his native Switzerland. He established Swiss Camp on the ice sheet in 1990 and added dozens of automated weather stations since then to measure the wind, the snow, and the melt We caught up with him in a cafe in Ilulissat.
Last year was our maximum melt year, maximum since we make measurements, since 1979. And we know from satellite measurements that we lost approximately 450 gigatons of ice. It's very hard to think how big is 450 gigatons of ice. I live in Switzerland. When we take all the ice in the Alps, the 450 gigatons of ice is five times the entire ice volume we have in the Alps. We lose on an annual basis now in Greenland.
And how much sea level rise does that mean?
Last year was an extreme, but if you take it over the last 3-4 years, close to 1 millimeter sea level rise comes from Greenland.
And that doesn't sound like a lot.
It does not sound like a lot, but we have to be aware when you talk about global sea level, that has very little meaning. Important is the local sea level rise. And locally, that can vary much by a factor of 2 or sometimes 3. And if you multiply 1 millimeter over 50 years, and then having a local effect that can easily make 0.5 meter sea level change in 50 years, which then has a major impact on the coastal regions of the world.
0.5 meter, about 1.5 feet, will devastate many coastal areas, and it won't stop there. Much, much more melt is inevitable in the centuries ahead, 70 feet more, if glaciologist Jason Box is right. And one more fact to consider. As the vast weight of all the ice on top of Greenland dwindles, the land below will start to lift. So Greenland will be one of the places least affected as the sea rises.
My old NPR colleague Neil Conan and writer Gretel Ehrlich, whose books on Greenland and ice include This Cold Heaven. Gretel narrates pictures worth seeing from their assignment in August. What does a sea of icebergs look like? It's at Bern and energyjournal.com. I'm Alex Chadwick. This is Bern. I'm Alex Chadwick in South Florida, where the Gulf Coast runs north and then west through Alabama, Mississippi, and into Louisiana. If Miami is the city most vulnerable to sea level rise, many experts say this is the most vulnerable region. It's also a big source of carbon pollution. Texas and Louisiana produce more greenhouse gases than any other states. So, the very industries that contribute to global warming are threatened by the rising seas that climate change has brought about. That's especially true in southern Louisiana, with huge energy and petrochemical plants on land that's sinking into the Gulf of Mexico. Reed Frazier has our report.
Louisiana is a nexus of oil and gas activity. Oil and gas comes in from offshore and winds through a maze of pipelines along the bayous and marshes of its coast. Much of it comes here, to the lowest reaches of the Mississippi River. The lower Mississippi is lined with refineries, petrochemical plants, and storage terminals. These plants make gasoline, the building blocks of plastics, rubber tires for our cars, and virtually every chemical that lives underneath our sinks. But this whole part of Louisiana is an increasingly dangerous place to live. Hurricanes have always been a threat to life here, but the situation is getting worse. To find out why, I came here, to Chalmette, Louisiana, a few miles from the Gulf of Mexico.
Is there something I should know about walking in this muck?
Yeah. Step on the plants when you can.
Stephen Estopinal is a surveyor in southern Louisiana. He's wearing white rubber shrimping boots, standing in shin-deep water. We're standing in what looks like a pond next to a highway. He's poking through thick muck with a shovel.
There it is, right there. What is that, 24 inches?
His shovel has struck an old road, a full 2 feet underwater, one he drove on as a teenager in the 60s. But over the years, water from the Gulf of Mexico kept getting onto the road, so the road had to be moved onto elevated ground a few feet over.
Hydraulically speaking, we're standing in the Gulf of Mexico right now.
When he was a boy, the road was flanked by trees and vegetation. Now, marsh grass and open water. You can see clear to New Orleans from here.
Now you can see one of the great cities of the world as it sinks below the sea.
He's not being melodramatic. This whole part of the state is sinking into the Gulf of Mexico. Why? Sea level rise is one factor. The world's oceans rose about 8 inches over the last 100 years. Another big reason is the land here is brand new, geologically speaking. It was brought by the Mississippi, overflowing its banks. But the modern Mississippi can't do that anymore. It's been tamed by dams and levees. So the delta is deprived of new sediment. So now, miles of thick delta sediments are compressing under their own weight. Gravity itself is pulling southern Louisiana down, just as the Gulf of Mexico is rising steadily. Again, Stephen Estopinol.
And it's causing all kinds of problems with the infrastructure. They have to build the roads up on hills. They have to build levees to keep the sea from coming in.
The wetlands here once served as a shield against hurricanes, but that shield is thinning. In its place, open water. Basically, the wall of green that once slowed storms down has become a runway for hurricanes.
Not only is there no more buffer, there's actually a mechanism for flow. There's actually a way for it to go sooner and bring more water further inland.
And that pathway for rushing water leads directly to refineries and chemical plants that line the Mississippi. Plants around the Gulf are fortifying levees and raising equipment off the ground to prepare for sea level rise. But you can't exactly pick up a refinery and move it, says Richard Metcalf. He's with the Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association.
It would cost about $3 billion to build a new refinery of a moderate size here in this geographic area.
Even if it wanted to relocate, the industry has to stay where it is, as close to the Gulf of Mexico as possible. That's where the oil and gas is, after all. Metcalf says the industry has learned how to better prepare for storms by keeping more liquids in storage tanks so they can't just float away and rupture, as happened at a refinery during Hurricane Katrina. But in the meantime, much of the infrastructure will remain in place, even if rising seas make it more costly to maintain. What does this mean for people who live near these plants? Russell Gelvin has lost 2 houses to hurricanes, once during Katrina and again last year to Hurricane Isaac.
See some of the mold still.
He brings me to see what's left of house number 2.
The house was 3 bedrooms. We had a formal dining room. The kitchen was here, utility room. Big.
This dinner. Was his house in Braithwaite Park. And, it's about 10 miles from New Orleans, and it's all of 3 feet above sea level. During Hurricane Isaac, water came up to his 2nd floor. He broke into the house from a boat through a bedroom window. About a day after the storm struck, he got word there had been a toxic spill in the area. 170,000 gallons of petrochemicals escaped into the floodwaters when the storm surge damaged storage tanks near his home. After months of gutting the house, he developed a strange condition on his lips. His wife felt sick whenever she came to the house, and his brother, who helped clear the house, had trouble breathing. Russell Gelvin said some of his neighbors had similar problems.
We don't know what it's going to cause, you know. I mean, you can't dwell on it. Who knows? 10 years from now, I might come down with cancer. How are they going to prove it? I got it from here.
It's here in Louisiana where climate data reveal a particularly troubling story. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, Louisiana's rate of relative sea level rise is the highest in the United States. Between rising seas and sinking land, the Gulf has gained 40 inches over the past 100 years here. This means that coming hurricane storm surges could punch the area even harder. By 2100, ocean levels on Louisiana's coast could rise by 2 feet or more. It's a daunting prognosis for the oil and gas industry and for Russell Gelvin. But in spite of all that he's gone through, Gelvin doesn't wish the industry would just go away. In fact, quite the contrary.
No, not really, because I know that, you know, a lot of people don't realize Louisiana produces a lot of the petrochemicals, whether we're producing it, refining it, whether it's coming up the mouth of the river. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the New Orleans and Louisiana area is a big boost for the economy.
Gelvin now lives in a 3rd house. It's just downriver from the one that flooded during Katrina. Kids practice football in a nearby park on a weekday evening. Galvin's new house sits inside a brand new flood wall that's close to 30 feet tall. It's part of a huge federal levee system built to protect New Orleans. The wall protected the area during Hurricane Isaac, and I ask him if it makes him feel safe.
I feel safe. They say, and this is the 100-year protection, who's saying we might get that 500-year storm?
He's willing to live with the risks of storms and spills to stay here. But if there is another big one, say another Katrina, Russell Galvin says he'll leave. For Bern, I'm Reed Frazier.
You can join Reed on an aerial tour of southern Louisiana. That's at our website, burnandenergyjournal.com. I'm Alex Chadwick, and coming up on Burn, one city actually is doing something to fight sea rise, maybe the richest city in the world, New York, New York. Next on Burn, from Sound Vision Productions and American Public Media.
Back with Burn, I'm Alex Chadwick in New York City, in a part of the city called Battery Park, the lower end of Manhattan, right in front of me, the Statue of Liberty. I'm here actually to go a few hundred feet away to the South Ferry subway station. This is the city's newest subway station, and when Superstorm Sandy hit a year ago, it was completely inundated. So I'm going to meet the chief environmental engineer for the New York City subway system, Tom Abdullah, and it's his job to make sure that does not happen again.
Your heart sank to the middle of your stomach when we saw the devastation and that all that hard work would go down the drain. But, you know, we're at it again, and we'll put it back together better than it was before.
Tom Abdullah took me behind a temporary wall down in the subway to see a feature of the new station that he helped design. It's a mosaic map of the old city back in the mid-1600s. It was still New Amsterdam then. This is at the top of a stairway that leads up from the subway track about 65 feet below. And listen to this. After Sandy, the floodwaters in this station came as high as the bottom of the map, covering the lower tip of Manhattan. So it was kind of a spooky parallel to what was actually going on in real life above ground. Water from the ocean completely covered the southernmost end of Manhattan. You can see the platform on our website, burnandenergyjournal.com. And so then we went down there to that platform with Tom Abdullah to see the current state of the cleanup, and they have made a lot of progress.
It's kind of eerie to be on a station platform that's not inundated with a lot of people.
These are big kind of ventilation fans you put in here that we're walking by.
Most of the subway system is naturally ventilated through the piston action of the subway, of the train. But down here, we have an HVAC system. So that was completely destroyed. That's why we have these fans running. We want to keep it as moisture-free as we can so mold doesn't develop.
I said goodbye to Tom Abdullah down in the subway station and came back up here to Battery Park to talk with a reporter friend, Dean Olscher. He's from New York. Dean, I asked you to bring me someplace in New York where we could talk about sea level rise. You said, let's meet in Battery Park. Why?
When Henry Hudson first captained the Half Moon into this area, the harbor protected the waters, and it was possible to bring a ship in here without being buffeted by the high seas. And it was a beautiful spot to create a settlement.
And safe.
And totally safe. And now is the source of the trouble that we've been experiencing as a result of Sandy. In Malcolm Bowman's Vision of the Future, New York would, in a way, be New Amsterdam once again. He's an oceanographer who runs the Storm Surge Group at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In 2008, Mayor Bloomberg appointed him to the New York City Panel on Climate Change. And Bowman is frustrated by New York City's response to Sandy.
The buzzword around town, the mantra, is resilience. And what does resilience mean? In this context, it means, look, it's inevitable, it's going to happen again. We can't stop Mother Nature, the fury of those storms. We're going to get flooded again, but let's just hope that next time around we're better prepared. That's resilience. To me, though, that's a statement of failure. It's a statement that we cannot protect the city so this never happens again.
Perhaps New York has become a little complacent because of the natural features, like lots of bedrock below all of those skyscrapers, that make it well-positioned to withstand rising sea levels.
It was a feeling of invincibility, really, that we were safe, we were protected between the coastlines of Long Island and New Jersey, and no hurricane could possibly hit here.
It's not just hurricanes. Other storms, just as dangerous, are now a part of life. And as Roland Lewis, the president of the Metropolitan Waterfront Alliance, explained to me, the quality that made this spot so attractive to Henry Hudson, the fact that it's a protected harbor, is the same quality that leaves it so vulnerable to storms.
If you look at a map, you see the shore of New Jersey, you see Long Island, and they point toward the New York Harbor. And when the cards line up as they did for a storm event like Sandy, that attribute of being a protected harbor, having a small opening, becomes a liability and water is forced in.
Forced into basements and ground floors of buildings. In some parts of lower Manhattan, the floodwaters were 6 feet and higher. Because of Sandy, New York has to once again renegotiate its lease with the sea. New York is getting high marks around the country for its leadership in dealing with rising sea levels. In June, the Bloomberg administration responded to Sandy with a 438-page plan called A Stronger, More Resilient New York. The Bloomberg plan calls for a series of levees and dikes strategically located at vulnerable points around the city, and things like sealing up tunnels. Roland Lewis used a word that was new to me when he described this as dry-proofing.
And then there's wet-proofing. The idea that you can let water in and let water out. Parks are wonderful places for that, where the harm will be minimal or expected if there's flooding.
As I walked with Lewis on a sunny fall day through Battery Park, we found ourselves suddenly standing in front of something that we did not expect.
Zelda.
A wild turkey that has taken up residence here and has been adopted by park workers.
Zelda, come here.
This turkey is walking right at us, and she thinks we have food, Zelda. Maybe. You get the feeling sometimes that nature is trying to take back the city. That's certainly how it has felt in Breezy Point in the years since Sandy. Breezy Point is a beach community in the Rockaways. With the Manhattan skyline about 20 miles off in the distance, you feel as if you might be in the next state. But in fact, I'm still within New York's city limits. It was here that water from Sandy came into contact with electrical wires and caused a fire that burned more than 100 homes to the ground. And it's from this spot, in Breezy Point, that Malcolm Bowman's vision for New York's future begins. It's modeled after projects undertaken in Europe.
Go to London and see the Thames River Barrier. Go to the Netherlands and see the Delta Project.
Which resulted from a storm surge in the North Sea in 1953, causing widespread flooding in the Netherlands, Belgium, and the UK, and leaving about 1,800 people dead. The Dutch response included building storm surge barriers, huge walls in the sea that keep out the ocean. Malcolm Bowman envisions two similar barriers for New York City. One of them would stretch from Breezy Point about 5 miles across the harbor over to Sandy Hook in New Jersey, and it would do triple duty as a bridge for cars and also for rail tracks and as a gate that would open and close as necessary to keep the ocean away from New York and northern New Jersey. And it would cost about the same as the Bloomberg plan, which he says is necessary but not sufficient. One argument against storm surge barriers is that they may be too ambitious, and not everyone is convinced they would work. Roland Lewis says he thinks that they should be tested. Malcolm Bowman is disappointed that the Bloomberg plan specifically excludes storm surge barriers.
Yeah, that surprises me, because Bloomberg, his first degree is in engineering.
For years, long before Sandy, Bowman has pushed for these barriers, and as a result, he has been called a prophet, Noah in particular. When it comes to his idea of walling out the ocean to protect New York City from future storms, he does seem like a lone voice in the wilderness.
Some of my colleagues say, look, Malcolm, the city is eventually doomed. Let's start planning a retreat. Let's start heading for the hills. And I say, look, that's never going to happen. That's not realistic. Look at the Dutch. You can't tell the Dutch to run for the hills. There are no hills. The whole country's flat as a pancake. So what have the Dutch done? They've decided we're going to stand and fight. That's in our genes. That's in our history. So we're going to strengthen our coastal resources. We're going to do what's necessary. We're going to train our engineers to be the best in the world. And we're going to stand and fight. And if we get 150, 200 years more, then we've done well.
Not to do so, he feels, is to betray the trust of the city's children. For Bern, I'm Dean Olscher in New York City.
This is Bern. I'm Alex Chadwick. I want to end this program where we began it, in South Florida and Miami, a city we started making up about 100 years ago. It's not here to exploit oil or timber or gold. It's not a hub on the way across America. Miami is a semi-tropical version of how we imagine paradise, warm, hospitable, full of light and water. It's here because we like these things. It's a dreamscape we've made real. Now, it's going away. In 50 years, probably less, there will be big changes, or people will begin to abandon it. Sure, you can elevate the base of the condo towers, but how will people get to them on flooded streets? How long will people live with that? All of this is a direct result of our energy policies, our carbon addiction. Somewhere behind the quiet eye elegance of our abundantly powered lives, there's a turbine whining, and many of them driven by coal. We complain that gasoline is too expensive, and we ignore its true costs. It costs Miami, the Gulf Coast, probably New York someday. That's a ways off. We can keep going the way we are a while longer, but we cannot escape those costs. Well, my generation probably can, but our children, our grandchildren, generations to come, for a very long time, they'll be paying. And that notion takes me back to a sun-blasted ridge in South Florida and the climate scientist from Florida Atlantic University, Nicole Hernandez-Hammer. She's saying her son is 6 years old now. Oh, I see. Too young to know about this.
Well, actually, I tell him about it now.
You do?
I do, and he's pretty quick. Of course, he doesn't understand it completely, but I want him to know that if we're able to adapt, if we're able to save our cities, then I want him to know that his mom was part of it. And that if we're not able to, I want him to know that his mom tried.
She says all this with a cool scientific composure, not showing a drop of distress. But I'm nearly blinded by the heat, the still, drenching air. And she looks up and asks a question of her own. Are you crying or sweating? Good question. For Bern, I'm Alex Chadwick. Bern, an Energy Journal, is produced and edited by Robert Rand, with Chris Julin and Christopher Johnson. The technical director and mix engineer is Robin Wise. Managing producer, Mary Beth Kirshner. Special thanks to Virginia Burkett, Dan Kyan, Barrett Golding, Luke Massman-Johnson, Marge Ostrushko, and composer Steve White. The executive producer is Barry Scott. For more information and to download this and other programs in our series, go to burnandenergyjournal.com. Burn is produced by Sound Vision Productions, with funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and the National Science Foundation, with additional support from the Edward W. Rose III Family Fund of the Dallas Foundation. Burn is produced in association with Marketplace and National Geographic's Great Energy Challenge. Burn, an Energy Journal, is distributed by APM, American Public Media.